Hey, Son. How's it going?
It's going well. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Thanks for joining this session.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm always interested in talking about AI, data, future of decision making, the meaning of life, the pursuit of happiness. Whatever you got, I'm interested in talking about it.
I would like to maybe talk about the things that you just said, the life part. Maybe I'm more interested in that now that you just poked the topic. the reason is like we are so much cramped, I would say, at this moment that, you know, we need to definitely talk about that first before getting into other more practical stuff.
Yeah, no, I think it's right. It's one of the things that it's funny that I talk about a lot is that people talk a lot about work-life balance and how you need to seek work-life balance. But the reality is that, you know, your work and your personal life, they aren't separate, right? And when life is difficult and your personal side, it affects your work and vice versa. And this year has been nothing but that, in that as difficult as our personal lives have gotten, as difficult as work has gotten, they kind of play off each other. And it's hopefully it pulls down that illusion that somehow there's a wall and that the only problem is figuring out, do I have the right number of hours in my personal life or the right number of hours in my working life? And going back to the fact that you know what, our lives are our lives and how we spend our time needs to fit in together. It's hopefully going to lead to much healthier practices in the future. Let me put it that way.
And in this perspective, like as an entrepreneur, obviously you have your own personal space, your personal life. And at the same time, you're also trying to run a business. You know, obviously there, you know, like you said, there is a balance between what you do and then the balance between your people that you are working with, you know, in your office space, perhaps at the same time, your personal space, perhaps the balance, you know, definition before the COVID was different to what kind of balance that you have now, or it's the same definition while we are in this pandemic.
I think it's hard to say because it's so variant on what your situation is. This goes back to that work-life balance. So for people who have kids and their kids are at home because the schools are closed and their daycares might be closed, it's very difficult. You're trying to provide childcare, provide some help in schooling your kids and remote learning while trying to do your job. And there are only so many hours in the day to do these things, and it's hard to focus on anything. If you are single and you're living by yourself, there's a lot of loneliness involved. You can't see people as much as you would. You don't have a family who's co-spacing, co-living with you to provide you company. And so the struggle is different. You actually have almost too much time in that you don't have anything else to do. There's no outlets for you. And so I think it means very different things depending on your life situation. And that is actually one of the challenges for people like me, which is if your team is diverse and they have very diverse life experiences, which ours does, what can you do to help them? Right? Because so many people have so many different needs, and how can you try to be there for them as best you can to give them the support that they need? Because in some cases, let's be honest, you know, the great challenge in mental health is that people who need the most help with mental health are often the last people to recognize it, which is the cruel characteristic of mental health issues. So how can you be there for people who don't even realize they might need help in the first place? It's tough. It's tough. I don't think there's a single right answer. I do think, though, like I said before, that companies are waking up to the reality that what they thought was work-life balance before was really just work-life scheduling. Mm-hmm. And you see a lot of large tech companies going fully remote for a long time. And I think a lot of what drove that was the realization that if they don't think about work-life balance as a scheduling problem, if they think about it as a whole person problem, they realize they actually can be as productive, if not more productive, as before. So if you, all of a sudden, for example, you don't have as many scheduled meetings, so people can design their own schedule every day, their own calendar, all of a sudden, they have a lot more flexibility to make sure their lives fit together. They can design something that's less stress for them. They can be more productive. If you let people, instead of trying to get work done in meetings, you let them get work done in their own way, at their own pace, all of a sudden, again, you start to see more productivity. So while there's no single answer, I do, like I said, think that there is an awakening that the way we thought that these things worked is different now. But honestly, like I said, the challenge is also that nobody's created equal. Everybody's different. Everybody has different needs. And it's hard to try to map all those needs and be there for people, especially with all the unknowns about when we might be able to do more or if we'll be able to do more.
And if you have to sort of, you know, think about a situation before COVID and I want to sort of, you know, try and learn what sort of person you were as in interacting with people and you preferred to going to office or you prefer to staying home or you are always leaning towards one versus the other?
It's a really good question. So we at Outlier, one of the core, when I started the company 5 years ago, one of our core values was diversity. It's something that I feel very strongly about, but also I think it's a competitive advantage in technology. If you can build a truly diverse team, you have so many more ideas, so much more innovation, so much more of an engine in the future. But as part of that, I think a lot of companies don't understand how committed you have to be to that, how thorough your commitment needs to go through and through. So for example, pre-COVID, one of the things we recognize is that to be diverse, and you're going to employ lots of people. Some of them, again, will have little kids, which means that, you know, they're very like they can't work before they drop their kids off at daycare. And they after they pick their kids up, they need to be with them, and maybe they can sign on again at night. And the entire spectrum they're on to people who are single who can actually meet their own schedules. And so one of the things that we recognized was that to have the company try to predetermine what that right working environment would be like to kind of dictate to people is actually one of the things that suppresses diversity in technology, to try to say that this is when you need to be in the office or this is how you have to do your work. It makes it impossible for those people. I mean, at Outlier, we've hired two women that were 8 months pregnant when we hired them. And a lot of them thought there was no opportunity for them in technology because the technology world is typically so difficult for someone in that position to make work. But if you really are committed to it, you end up in a world where they can make their own schedule. And so for us, even when we had our offices open, we only had a 3-day in the office policy anyway. The offices were for use on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. People work from home on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We have a lot of remote team members as well. And that allows you to make your own schedule. And some of us could choose. I actually personally choose to go into the office. I like having an office to go to. But many people in our team, it was difficult or it wasn't conducive to doing their best work to do that. They prefer to be alone or at home, or they have kids trying to do that balance. So by making it flexible and letting people determine for themselves the right working balance, we found that not only is our team more productive, but it's more diverse. You find, like, you look at Outlier, it is much more diverse than typical tech companies. And it only continues to increase on that year over year because it gives you that chance that you don't have at other places. And that's what I meant that other companies, I think, are waking up to that and realizing that what they thought was necessary to drive productivity wasn't actually driving productivity. It was driving the illusion of productivity. It was driving the illusion that they were getting more work done. Whereas in reality, when you start to respect your employees as people and trust them to make adult decisions, you know what happens? Magically, it turns out they make good decisions and they are more productive. And in fact, they actually trust you more because you're trusting them and not treating them like children, which is, I think, a big step forward for our industry.
And from your perspective, like you touched the subject of diversity and then, you know, your working culture before COVID. I want to sort of, you know, try and understand from your perspective, how do you really think about diversity? Like, you know, do you think it is diverse group of people coming together and working? That's one way to think about diversity. Or do you think different races of people coming together and working? Or the third one, I want to also give you the third one, is having a diverse opinion, right? You know, you have a different opinion of people coming together and being able to respect those opinion and those kind of culture, right? So how do you see your position in all those different examples that I just said?
And I think that I'll talk a little bit about my personal experience and why diversity is important to me, which is that I grew up in New York and I grew up in a fairly diverse place. And for me, as growing up, it was just that was how the world was. I didn't know anything different. And as I went off to college and had jobs and I was in much less diverse worlds, I suddenly felt very uncomfortable. And I'll say that what I felt like was that if the population of your team, if the composition of your team doesn't match the kind of diversity of our population, there's a big question, are you really hiring the best people? Are you really reflecting the best ideas? Because if people have exactly the same life experience that I do, are they really going to come up with very divergent ideas or different perspectives? And I'll give you some examples about how that plays out at Outlier, because for us, diversity is all dimensions. The most diversity comes from having people with different life experiences, different backgrounds, different ideas, different ways of working, different ways of communicating. And what it means is that for us, it's a competitive, the reason I refer to it as a competitive advantage is that it forces you to do a few things that most companies don't do. One is that it forces you to really think about, are we looking as hard as we can for the best people? Because I think that it's funny to think about if you're running a search for a position and all of the applicants and all of your finalists are white men, is it really the case that you've searched far and wide hard enough for the best people? Because, you know, statistically speaking, it's very unlikely that all the best people are white men. So So one way to think about it is that if you aren't sourcing and bringing in diverse people, maybe you aren't actually tapping into the best talent pools and hiring the best people. The second way to think about it is that diversity internally into a team forces you to be intentional about things that otherwise you might gloss over. And I'll tell you, at one point, I remember I was in a meeting. I can't remember where it was. It was obviously a meeting of white men. And somebody made a joke about lacrosse. And everybody laughed. And I thought it was so strange because lacrosse is not a super popular sport. Not many people know the rules of lacrosse. And even fewer people would get a joke about lacrosse. But everyone in that meeting found it to be funny. And it was something that nobody thought about. There was no intentionality of realizing there's people that have different backgrounds and different experiences. And once you give way to that kind of homogeneity of experience, you just start to not think about why you do things. You start to realize that you start to do things just because that's how you've done it, or that's how everybody thinks is okay to do it. But if you have a diverse team, you have to be intentional about things. You have to think about, why do we do these things? Is this the right thing to do? And so, for example, once you have new mothers in your office and you have things like lactation rooms, you start to realize that you have to plan for people's schedules. Many people who have never had kids don't understand how difficult lactation is for new mothers and how it works into their work schedule and how challenging it is for them. And if you've never had mothers on your team, there's nobody to voice those concerns and bring those to your attention. And you actually can create a very adverse working environment for those people. Just because you don't understand, just because you don't realize that this person's experience that you've never seen, that you can't ever see, or you might not see for quite a long time, is so different than yours. And that goes across the spectrum. I mean, people have different communication styles. People have different working styles. And just because someone would do a job differently than I might do it, doesn't mean that I'm better. It doesn't mean that they're worse. It just means that they're different. And that's good. The more people with different approaches is important. So one of the things we do at Outliers, our interview process, is focus on a work simulation. None of these silly like whiteboarding sessions or asking questions, things that introduce bias into the process. We say, listen, you want this job. This is what the work is like. Show us how you would do it. And we come in with very little opinion about how it should be done, because frankly, if we came in with an opinion saying, this is what we want you to do, and this is how we want you to do it, you know what we're going to do? We're going to hire people that would do it exactly the same way I would do it. And I don't need that. I need different approaches. And so by hiring people through a method where they can show their best work, they can show how they work, they can show how they would approach a problem. And in many cases, it's surprising. They're very different. People have a diverse way of approaching problems, diverse ways of communicating about those problems. And that's good. And the more of that you have, the more intentional you get as an organization. And the more you realize that things that you were doing out of habit may not have been healthy. They may not have been the right thing. They may not have even been good ideas. But nobody questioned them because there was no diversity of experience or diversity of thought or diversity of opinion happening there. And so I think that those are three examples of the kind of avenues that diversity fuels, but it's a holistic concept. It's, you want to have a team of people, hopefully, that reflects the population as much as it can, because that ends up being, from in my opinion, the best measure of, are you really assembling the great team, or are you just hiring the best people of people you can easily find? And that's not the same thing.
And if you're having a homogeneous sort of thought within the team, you know, based on your experience in the past, or maybe you're assembling a new team where you thought maybe for this kind of, you know, project, maybe you want mm-hmm. to have a team which has a homogeneous nature. You know, they have the similar kind of view about the problem, and they have a similar way of solving the problem. What kind of challenge do you see with that kind of approach?
So I think you've highlighted it well. If you have a team who all have the same experience, the same thought process, and they're given a problem, they're not going to explore every possible solution, which means there's an entire categories of possible solutions, which might be better, that will go unexplored just because it doesn't occur to them that this is how things could be done, or this is how things could be addressed. And I'll go back to our interview process, for example. Doing a work simulation as part of an interview is hard. It's hard on us because we have to spend a lot of time designing it. It's hard on the candidates coming in because they have to spend a bit more time on it than they might for other positions at other companies. And so intuitively, if you had this homogenous team of people and they don't understand why it's necessary to let people express different ways of doing the work, because everybody on that team would do the work the same way. And so therefore they assume that there is a quote unquote right way to do it. You would never invest time in creating this kind of work simulation interview process. However, if you do, what you find out is that it's enormously more effective in predicting future success in position, much more so than traditional interview processes. And you find out the candidates have a better experience because they're getting a sense of what it's like to work at the company. So they're not coming in and wondering, if I take this job, what will it be like? And it turns out they actually love it, and it's much more rewarding and means that you can have much higher conversion rates of offers accepted if you do invest in it. All of those things are not obvious. And because they're not obvious, you probably wouldn't choose to pursue that path of a work simulation interview process if you had a homogenous team who didn't realize that there are lots of different ways to approach the same problem. That's just one example. There are many, many more of them. And I think that one of the things that you see, and I, you know, I don't do a lot of angel investing, but when I do, it's in underrepresented founders and on teams that are hiring people up from underrepresented groups. The amount of innovation and the amount of grit and the amount of progress they make is clear. They try things that nobody else would try that wouldn't even be obvious to people outside of these small bubbles. And as a result, I think that is a competitive advantage. I think it does drive things forward. And the better yet, I think that what you're starting to see is companies realizing that it is a competitive advantage. And they're starting to take it seriously in a way they didn't take it seriously before. Whereas I think in previous years, people, they said they would focus on diversity and inclusiveness because it was popular to do that. But they didn't really. Like, they didn't do the hard work of actually making structural changes to do that. They just said they were going to focus on it. Maybe they did some press releases, but really they didn't do the hard work to really make structural changes. And now what I think you're seeing is that's changing, is that there are, people are realizing they have to do the hard work. They have to make these difficult changes. I have been very excited just this year. I have a list of about a dozen companies that have adopted this work simulation interview process that I described because they saw the results that we were able to drive through it. And they realized that their model was not working at all. And they needed to do something different, and they're making the hard decision to change. And so I think that the results are obvious. The challenge with the technology industry, and obviously you know it as well as I do, is that it has a very short memory because it's so much of what we do in technology is driven by innovation. And so much of that innovation is very short-lived that things like investing in diverse inclusiveness and building a diverse team that have longer-term payoffs that are not immediately visible are hard for some teams to see. They're looking for, okay, that next growth hack that'll increase my user base tomorrow, or that next feature I can build that'll increase customer engagement. They're always looking for the fast payoff, the fast return on that investment. And when you start to think about longer term investments, it is harder for a lot of people in technology because it's not a natural motion. But as those longer term effects kick in, I think they're so obvious and they're so hard to ignore that they're becoming a key part of how companies are thinking about the future. And that's good. That's exciting for me. As a quick short story, I often am lucky enough to talk to new college seniors who are thinking about working in technology after graduation. They may come to Silicon Valley, or I'll do a virtual conference with them to talk about what it's like to work in Silicon Valley, what it's like to work in technology and startups. And one of the things that I've always asked them at the end of those sessions was that, you know, as the candidates that these companies want to hire, the most important thing they can do for the betterment of our industry and society is make it clear to those companies they're interviewing with that these things that we're discussing are important, that they're not just important, they're part of the decision process that they will make in terms of what companies to join. And the reason I think it's so important to bring it up is that, you know, a lot of companies won't change unless there's an economic imperative. And one of the things that creates an economic imperative is if you can't hire the best college graduates because they're looking for diversity, inclusiveness, openness, transparency, and those are things that you don't do, not really, and you lose those candidates, that's an enormously strong economic impact that motivates change. And I'm happy to say in more recent years, if you were to go back 5 years or so when I would talk to those seniors in college, a lot of them had never thought about that. They hadn't considered how much power they have in the equation of interviewing and how much strength they have to change the industry. But now they do. It's amazing how much has changed, how much they're more aware of the power that they have to produce that change through economic means. And it's exciting to me because if that happens, if all of these seniors and colleges start to realize how much power they have by making it clear what they expect to see in their future employers, that means real change is happening. And again, it's always slower than we want, and it's not always obvious at the beginning, but it gives me a lot of hope for the future.
Interesting. I want to sort of, you know, bring you back into assembly part of the team. What I'm curious about is when you are onboarding a certain background of people versus the other, have you felt any difference in terms of onboarding challenges, right? So have you experienced those kind of challenges depending on where the person is coming from?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'll give you a basic example. There are people who prefer to speak, like we're speaking right now. They prefer to speak live or in person. That's their preferred method of communication. And there are people on the other end of the spectrum where actually they find speaking to be very uncomfortable. They would prefer to write things down or chat over text messaging or over instant messaging. And there's even other people who are not very good at communicating in the moment. They need time to go back, you know, come up with their ideas and then communicate all at once after they've had time to think about it. And there are obviously a diversity of, is a spectrum. So there's a whole spectrum of options in the middle. And so once you start hiring a diverse team, you can't guarantee any longer that everybody will communicate the way that you do, or even communicate the way that everybody on your team does today. They might have an entirely different way that they prefer to communicate. Whereas, you know, for example, a lot of companies use, I guess they call it the coffee test or the beer test. Is this somebody I'd want to go out and get a beer with or get a coffee with? And that's such a horrible metric, because what you're saying is that I care a lot about whether or not I feel comfortable communicating with this person, not is this person going to be able to do a good job, and not can I communicate with this person effectively, but do I feel comfortable? Do they communicate the way that I do? Do they get along the way that I do? Do we have common interests? So once you have this diverse group of people with different communication styles, you realize you have to offer a variety of ways to get onboarded. So at Outlier, for example, we have a radical transparency policy where not only is everything written down, but everything is available for people to read. That includes all of our, you know, all of our board materials going back to the beginning of the company, all of our investor updates, all of our plans and strategies and stuff are available to everybody so that they can read them. But we also offer what we call Outlier Academy, which is a live session with people like myself where we talk people through that. We explain why we do these things. We explain all the reasoning behind it. And so what it means is that we give people essentially, and those are just two examples, we give people a variety of options on how to get onboarded, on how to learn, so that we don't assume that this method of communication or that method of communication is the way that is best for them. And in doing so, this goes back to that intentionality. It means that now all of a sudden you're more intentional about how you communicate in multiple different ways. So it sounds like a lot of work, right? To have an onboarding process where you communicate it a few different ways because it seems like you're having to do the same thing over and over again. But you know what it does? It turns out that you actually now get much better at multiple ways of communicating, right? And regardless of what your preference is, we can hopefully agree that different methods of communication are more appropriate for different things. So for example, it means that we do write everything down. And that means we can more easily go back to see what we had written down before. It means that we get good at having these discussions live, but we try to keep them fairly short. And so our meetings, even our company meetings on average, try to be no more than 20 to 30 minutes. And so all of a sudden it has a lot of follow-on effects of making you very conscious of how you communicate and how these different modes interplay. But it does, like I said before, these kind of things require more effort than companies are used to putting into them. Most companies are used to having one onboarding process that's designed for everybody to go through. Turns out some people go through it well, some people go through it poorly. Is it their fault? Is it the company's fault? Nobody knows. But once you start to pull that back, I think it becomes, again, a competitive advantage because you're more intentional and it leads to later stage improvement.
Based on the examples that you provided, like the different method of communications or different preferred method of communication, have you seen a different efficiency, you know, when the person actually have onboarded and then they have started to work on your project as such? Do you see that there is a difference the way people talk to you versus the kind of work that they generate as an output, right? So do you see that based on the kind of communication that they did during the onboarding time versus the output, right? So how do you see that relationship there?
The answer is resoundingly yes. And I think it comes from two places. When people realize that you are open to their unique preference or their unique status, and you're an open and transparent, diverse organization, and also that you trust them, that you're giving them a bunch of options and you're letting them choose what's best for them, you're letting them choose what works for them, you start to build trust much faster than most organizations can. And building trust with your employees is so important because, you know, a lot of what drives technology is innovation, and innovation comes from creativity. And every study that's ever been done shows creativity does not emerge unless people feel comfortable and trusted, and so that they can focus on these more interesting ideas, which means that your path to new ideas, to new input, to new change is going to be much faster if you build trust more quickly, and also if you communicate in the way that people are best able to absorb that information. And so the combination of it is that is the path of productivity. How long does it take somebody new to be fully productive, to be able to do everything you need them to do? And we find that it's radically faster in this kind of world because we're trusting them and building that trust in a two-way street, but also allowing them to absorb information in the way that's best for them. And what that means also is I kind of think about hiring. I think a lot of companies think about hiring where success is filling the position. Success is having somebody show up on day one into this position. And that's good. We filled that position, so our hiring was a success. I think success is much better measured after a week or after a month. Is that employee as excited or more excited as they were when they accepted the offer because of the work that they're doing? Are they more excited because they're seeing all these great things about the company that weren't obvious? And if you start to think about hiring like that, where success is measured not by that they started and not by did they onboard, but how happy are they in the job that they accepted? All of a sudden, you start to realize that a lot of these things are more important than you might otherwise think. That onboarding isn't just the means of kind of like bringing somebody in and giving them the tools and setting them off to a job. Onboarding is a big part of making sure people feel like I can do more than my job. I can contribute in better ways and new ways. I can bring my whole self. And many of the things that I might contribute to the organization might not have anything to do with the job I was hired for, but I want to do those things because the company trusts me and I trust the company in return. And so I see it play out every day. And it's exciting because I think it's the kind of thing that an organization like ours or any tech company is so hungry for, which is these kind of second order effects. How can you grow faster the bigger you are? Because you know most companies grow slower the bigger they get. But can you grow faster the bigger you are? And that ends up being the definitive problem of tech companies is how do you grow faster the bigger you get? And this is one way. If you can hire people and they can contribute not only to do their job as effectively as soon as possible, but they can help you in other ways as well. All of a sudden, you have all these small booster rockets moving the company forward. And it's exciting. And I think it's one of those things that becomes a compounding effect as you get bigger. One of the things that I use to measure the effectiveness of these kind of interview processes is, okay, it's one thing to say, what is the ratio of offers to accept? That's a lot of companies use that. I care a lot more about, do you interview people and do they, even if you turn them down, do they recommend other people for the position? Because if you do a really good job about showing what you do and all these things that I mentioned are true, just because you turn somebody down for a job and it wasn't a good fit for them, they should want the people in their network to have an opportunity. They should think that this is something rare and something an opportunity they want to share. And I'm happy to report that all my companies, that is true, that we have many applicants and many hires that were referred to us by people who interviewed for a position, but we turned down because it wasn't the right fit for us. And that then becomes a compounding again on your recruiting process, because not only are you sourcing employees from your recruiting efforts, and not only are you sourcing employees from the network of people on your team, you're sourcing people from the networks of people who have applied to your company, even if you turn them down. And again, that's a way that you can grow faster the bigger you get. So I think that it ends up paying off quite well in the long term. And I think that, again, it's hard to see on the surface, but I think it's becoming more obvious as people watch success stories and how that kind of pays off.
Right. And you mentioned about innovation a couple of times and in relation to the diversity within the company's culture. I'm kind of thinking, you know, in order to be innovative, you need to be able to have the environment which is challenging at the same time inspires you to sort of, you know, innovate, right? So you have a big mission in front of you where the environment itself is actually, you know, forcing you to innovate, right? Or you see the problem. And then people are there to actually solve that problem. So in that perspective, how do you create that environment where people are waking up early at the same time, they're saying, oh, this is something that I need to solve today, right? So how do you create that sort of environment?
And I think a lot of companies get this wrong because they believe that innovation is something you can give to like an innovation team, or you can have like an innovation group or something like that. And I think that's just not how it works. Creativity is nonlinear. It doesn't happen that way. The the best way I can tell you that it's worked for me in my career, because the great thing about Outlier and my previous companies is a lot of the best innovative ideas have come from unexpected parts of the organization, is that people need to feel empowered. You have to be able to give them a problem to solve, but not give them a way to solve it, not mandate this is how you're going to solve it, and give them the flexibility to figure out the best way forward. And they have to feel empowered. They have to feel trusted. They have to feel trust in you. And if they do, what they will inevitably do is find very creative and new solutions to problems where what they find was not obvious to anyone else in the organization. And I think it's very hard as a leader to do that. It requires a lot of confidence in yourself and a lot of confidence in your team, because it's much easier to be very micromanaging, very easy to be prescriptive, to tell people in your team to do something and do it a certain way. And to give somebody a problem and not know how they'll solve it and realize, and by the way, they probably will make mistakes along the way somewhere, and you'll have to do something about them, even if those are mistakes that you might have avoided if you had done it yourself or done it the way that you knew to do it. It requires a lot of self-confidence and a lot of confidence in the organization. But if you do that, if you have that confidence and empower people in that way, innovation comes from everywhere. And it's exciting because you start to realize how much that diversity of experience and how much the diversity of how people approach problems pays off in ways that were never visible until just this one moment with this one problem where three people came with three entirely different solutions, all of which are really interesting and brilliant, and all of which have a potential for the future, and none of which I would have come up with on my own. It's exciting. And that's, in my mind, that's the only way to approach it. But in order to get there, all the other things that I said had to be true, which is you had to have a diverse group of people who have different ideas, who have, you know, different approaches to problems and probably different communication styles. You have to be willing to trust your employees and build that trust very clearly by being transparent, by being open to them. But if you do all those things and you empower them, I think that's where, in my opinion, continuous innovation comes from. It doesn't come from a team. It doesn't come from a project. It doesn't come from an initiative, because those are things where you're creating a framework and you're creating an expectation that this is what innovation will look like. And that's not really how innovation works. Innovation is going to be those unexpected moments in the shower or the crazy idea you had when you're doing something entirely different. And those things you facilitate in these other ways. And it is interesting that you watch. It's hard, especially for first-time founders and first-time managers, to be that empowering to their employees, because it's scary, because your team's performance reflects on your performance. And a lot of people are scared of underperforming and they want to make sure that they can guarantee success. And so they end up telling people what to do. I'll give you an example. I interviewed once for an executive position at a very large, well-known Silicon Valley tech company. And this was in the product team. And I was interviewing all the different directors of product about how they decided what to do. Like, where did those next ideas come from? How did the product roadmap get built? And it was sitting there, it was me and three of them. And I was asking these questions and they smiled at me and said, oh, the CEO tells us what to do. And I started laughing. I was like, that's pretty funny. No, seriously, what is the process of deciding on those features? What's the process of deciding where you're going? And they looked at me dead serious and they're like, no, the CEO tells us what to do. And that is shockingly common in technology industries, that the leadership don't empower the employees. They tell you what to do and how to do it. And frankly, a lot of high growth companies, that's true. And people overlook it because they're so exciting to be on the ride, that the business is growing so fast. And that's the exciting part of it. And they'll overlook some of these things. But the reality is, you're not going to innovate if that's true. If all the ideas are coming from the top, you're not really innovating. And so you have to have this kind of other approach. And it's hard. I want to admit it's difficult. It's always a struggle, because the risk of failure and the risk of mistakes is so high, but it is vastly preferable to the alternative.
Yeah, you touched a very good subject that I sort of, you know, wanted to also talk about. But since you touched it, I'm kind of thinking now that, you know, you are the CEO of the company, and then this is a two-sided question. So what I was thinking about is, like, you know, you are a CEO of the company, you have a competitor, so you see different features that are being, you know, done by those company. And then you are like, wow, what if, you know, my company would also do the same thing? That's one side. And then the other side is, like, you know, the team has come up with a different list of features that they would like to see. And now you have to sort of, you know, decide, or let's say you want the team to decide, how do you see those things coming towards the team, right? So do you want to inspire the team to sort of, you know, look into the features that others have done and to sort of, you know, also at least mimic or do better than that? Or to sort of, you know, look into your own backlog and say, hey, you know, these are the, some of the things that we need to sort of, you know, focus on rather and stick to that decision, right? So how do you see that?
It's a good question. This goes to my general product approach to product strategy, but also my belief in what it means to win in technology and specifically in startups. And I will say this, which is I am a firm believer that the only thing that matters is what makes you different than all those other products, all those other companies. And so much so that 110% of your effort should go into the things that set you apart from other companies. And almost none of your effort should go into reproducing what they're doing or getting to feature parity and these sorts of things. Actually, years ago, I wrote a blog post about this called, I think it was called Nobody Got Acquired for Paying Their Bills on Time. Because in a lot of cases, companies do focus on things that aren't differentiating, like paying your bills. How efficiently do you pay your bills? How efficiently do you roll out new feature parity? These sorts of things. Because it feels like progress. It feels like work. And I think in these kind of companies, often motion is confused with progress, is that people see things happening. They are having meetings. They're building features. And they feel like they're making progress forward. And that's really not happening because the only way you can make progress in this industry is by doing something that nobody else does, by pushing the state of the art forward. Because if somebody's going to buy your product or a user is going to use your app, they're going to use it because yours does something that none of the other options they have does, whatever that might be. And if all your effort isn't going into that thing that makes you unique, then you're probably wasting that effort because you frankly don't have a lot of effort to go around. You're, you know, by definition, unless you're, I guess, one of the large tech companies, you probably don't have as many people as you'd like or as much time as you'd like or as much money as you'd like. And so if all that effort isn't going into what sets you apart, it's probably not actually progress. And so to answer your question, I think that it actually gets a lot easier to answer those questions when you think about it this way, because I care a lot less about what the competitors are doing. And I care a lot more about what can we do that will set us apart today and set us apart in 6 months and set us apart a year from now and 2 years from now. Because that's what will make us successful. And everything else just becomes noise. And I think that's a big part of innovation that you're highlighting, which is a really good point. Just because you have so many diverse ideas and so many creative, innovative ideas does not mean you pursue them all. And I think that that's true. And when I talked about empowering people and giving them problems and letting them solve them, you do. You generate a whole lot of new innovative solutions. You're not going to pursue them all. But that's okay. I think that this goes back to intentionality. It's better to have made the choice not to pursue an innovative new idea than never had it in the first place. Because if you never have it in the first place, you're not really in the position of making a decision. And what we want to do is we all want to make decisions, because otherwise, if you're not making decisions, you're just along for the ride. And honestly, this, if you're along for the ride, you're probably not going to win in this market. And so a lot of it is designed, do I have the option to select from the best ideas? And if you really do have an innovative culture, the answer is probably yes. The same thing is true of hiring, right? Just because we have a diverse hiring process doesn't mean we hire multiple people for the same position. But it hopefully should mean that we have a chance to choose between the best people. And that means our team will be better for it. And that ends up being an enormously difficult part. And in so much as the best skill you can possibly have as a founder, as a leader, is being able to say no to things. Being able to say, listen, these are all great. This is all exciting. We can only do one, and this is the one we're going to do. And that part is hard. It's very difficult. But the heuristic that I use is, okay, thing we choose should be something that if we invest in it, sets us further apart from the competition instead of making it more similar.
And where do you see your customer fitting into, you know, this whole question of not really chasing your competitors at the same time, just trying to be unique? And where do you fit in the customer's, you know, centricity there?
And I think that I have two opinions on this. One is I'm a big believer in being very customer focused and customer centric, and that customers are your best. They aren't just revenue. They're not just users. They're your best asset in terms of learning about what you can do. At the same time, customers or users of your app, they're often not very reliable witnesses in terms of what they want you to do. What they are very reliable witnesses regarding is what they like and what helps them and what they enjoy using. And with that lens on, it means that you can't go to your customers and ask them, what should we do? Or what would you like us to do? Because the answers you get will not only be difficult to interpret, honestly, most of the time, they probably won't even be accurate. And it's not because customers are lying to you. It's because they honestly usually don't know. But if you bring them something, if you bring them an idea or a concept or something, they're great at telling you if they like it. And they're great at telling you about what works about it, what doesn't work. They're great critics in that way. And so the questions are becoming not how much do you listen to your customers, but how much do you bring to them and how much of a voice do they have through that process of telling you what they think of these ideas, these innovative things, because the more that that's true, the faster you move forward. And that's how you ensure that you are setting yourselves apart. The second part, and I think this is really important, and I don't think a lot of companies think about this, which is if you're starting a company or building a company, you probably have a fair bit of expertise in that industry. You know a lot of things about how it works. You see a lot of nuance in it. And so when you're building a new product, you see all of the value in it, which might not be obvious to somebody on the surface, but that doesn't have that expertise. Or it's the kind of thing that's so new, but it requires a bit of explanation or a bit of using it to figure out how different it really is. Because on the surface, it might not look different, but once you get below the surface, there's a lot of difference there. And those typically are things that kill companies, because I think you need what I call visible differentiation. Somebody has to pick up your product and in the first 30 seconds realize that it is something new, something different. Because if you have that, what it does is it kicks in critical thinking. And you need people to use critical thinking, because otherwise, A, the feedback they give you won't be very interesting. It'll just be regurgitating things that they thought of before, or things that happened in the past. But it also means that they will take a critical eye to your product and they will think about what you do differently and give you a chance to show what you're doing differently and earn that extra time to make your case. And so many companies bury that difference below the surface, or that requires so much effort to get at. You have to be a user of the product for a while before you see it, or you have to have a lot of expertise to be able to see it. And it's very hard to build these kind of visibly differentiated products. But if you do, what you end up in a world of having a product that immediately kicks into critical thinking because they don't doesn't look like what people have seen before. And because you're in critical thinking, the quality of feedback you get from these customers is higher because they're thinking about this now logically, deeply, and they're focused on it instead of just kind of thinking about the last time they use a product like this. What did they look for in their last RFP or their last app that they use for sharing photos? If you get people thinking critically, you start to get really good feedback. And so those are that's how I think about it, in that customers have to be the center of your universe. That doesn't mean you're just sitting there taking notes about what they ask for and going doing that. It means that you are bringing them idea, that you're building trust, you're getting critical thinking going, they're thinking about your product, they understand what's new and exciting, and then you're bringing them ideas and they're telling you what they think of them, and that becomes the iteration loop. And there's a lot of people that aren't great at that because it does take a while. You know, the iteration loop of bringing an idea to a customer, getting their feedback, changing the idea, bringing it back, getting more feedback, changing the idea, it feels very slow. It feels very frustrating. And most people, again, that are used to very short feedback loops get very frustrated very quickly. But that's what innovation looks like. That's actually the pace of innovation that you want. It isn't this spark of genius in the lab late at night where I build something that nobody thought about and all of a sudden it's done. Innovation is a very slow and iterative process that starts with an idea that has potential. And that idea hits reality. And once it hits reality, it reacts and changes. And some of it that seemed like a good idea wasn't a really good idea, but this other part of it actually looks like it has potential, and let's build on that and see where it goes. And it's very frustrating in that way. But what ends up happening if you follow that is that you end up having a continuous flow of innovation. And that's what ends up keeping you separated from the competition.
Right. Now, let's talk about the background that you have. When you have ideas, right? You have great ideas, you work hard, and you assemble a team. And then you create wonderful products, but you end up not being able to sell it, or people don't buy it, and you end up losing that whole momentum that you have. How often were you in that particular situation? You are like, shit, this is a very crap idea. Maybe.
Oh man, you've hit it on the head, because that is, and I'll give you my diagnosis of why that happens so often, which is, people fall in love with solutions instead of the problems that they're solving. That they have this idea for an app and they really like the idea for the app and they want to build the app, but they don't focus on what problem it's really solving or why people want to use it. And once it's done, nobody uses it because you hadn't thought it through first. And so I prefer to focus on problems. Like when I was, I'll give you an example. When I was thinking about starting a company that eventually became Outlier, I started out just collecting problems. Just, I had a list of, I think, a dozen different interesting problems, of which what became Outlier was one of them, which is people are drowning in data and they don't know what questions to ask. And all of the existing tools they have are great at providing answers to questions, but nothing actually helps them figure out what questions they should be asking. And that was the problem. And I had a dozen of those across different industries, different things. And if you start out that way and you don't get committed to a solution or any particular solution, you stay committed to the problem, it gives you a chance to really figure out what solution will work in addressing it. But since you started with a problem and hopefully you qualify the problem, you never have this issue where nobody wants it or nobody uses it, because you started with a problem that if there was a solution, people would love it. And the best problems are problems where you don't have to explain to somebody they have the problem. If you have a good problem and you mention it to somebody, they should say, oh yes, this is a big deal. Do you have a solution? What's the solution? Do you have anything? I need help. That's a reaction that you get from people when you have a real problem. And often the interesting thing about that is the solutions are non-obvious. And so I'll be honest with you, when I started Outlier, I started with these dozen problems and I started whittling them down. A dozen problems became six became three. And when I chose this problem for Outlier, it was clearly the best problem in terms of being the most acute problem, the biggest potential of ones I had talked about. But I honestly didn't know if you could solve it. I didn't know if it was possible. There was a very likely world where it wasn't solvable, where there was no way to build, for example, software that would be able to ask questions of large amounts of data or bring you questions based on large amounts of data at high fidelity without you telling it what to look for. And so, you know, we just started at it and we iterated through. And I think eventually we tried lots of solutions, honestly, like, I don't know, a half dozen different possible solutions, most of which were embarrassingly bad in retrospect. And eventually we found one that has worked, and that's what the business of Outlier has been built on. But by starting with the problem instead of the solution, you give yourself flexibility to innovate, to iterate, to learn, to adapt. And as customers give you feedback, you know, a lot of cases, if you love the solution and customers give you feedback, you find ways to rationalize it away. You're like, yeah, the customer said this, but they didn't really understand it. Or they said this, but they didn't really, you know, they'll get it better in the future if they use it longer. And if you don't love the solution, if you love the problem and you listen to customers, you start to see that what they're telling you often has a few layers to it. That the customer says that, yeah, I like this, but it doesn't do these things. And then you start to think about, okay, it doesn't do those things, but why are those things important to the customer? Why do they care about those things? Why, out of everything else they could have talked to me about, did they choose to talk to me about that? And you start to really peel back and realize where those opportunities are. And I'll be honest with you, it's also scary. It's scary to start with a problem without knowing if there is a solution, because it's very likely that you waste your time because there is no solution. And that happens all the time. There's entire generations of technology innovation trying to solve problems that it turns out there was no good solution for. And that's, a lot of money has been spent down those routes. But at the same time, I think that's the cost of innovation, is taking the chance that there will be a destination if you do pursue it. And it also becomes a barrier to entry because, you know, when I was starting Outlier, it wasn't just me that didn't know if there was a solution to this problem. Nobody knew if there was a solution. And one of the best ways to be differentiated against the competition is to pursue something that nobody else may think is even solvable or even possible to be done. And as long as you keep pursuing that, that's a guaranteed way to stay separated from the competition, or at least to give yourself a significant head start. Because by the time that they see your success, they realize there is a solution. Hopefully you're so far ahead that it's hard for them to catch up.
Just from the entrepreneurship perspective, right? So you see a problem and you try to say, okay, you know, maybe I'll try to find a solution. So you try different alternatives, right? Like you said, like you tried a few different types of alternatives and you ended up selecting one of it. What are the elements that you thought were necessary to be an Outlier before you said, okay, this would be the kind of solution that we want to pursue?
That is criteria you have to have coming in. I'll tell you what my criteria was, which is probably different for most people. I had essentially three criteria. One is, it had to be an opportunity that was going to get bigger as time went on, meaning that the winds of history were at your back. And so the problem, in this case, of data overwhelming people, that was only getting bigger, clearly. And it's still bigger today than it was 5 years ago. It's going to be much bigger in 5 years than it is today. But also the product opportunity was getting bigger, that the number of companies that would want to adopt something like Outlier had to keep growing as well. And the reason that was so important for me was that so much of building innovative technology companies, you're trying to fight into the wind, that there's so much resistance to adopting new things that it's hard. You need the wind at your back to give you a little extra effort to try to get through those hard days. And so that historical imperative was really important to me, that it had to be continually getting bigger, both the problem and the solutions opportunity, and those things had to be important. The second thing for me is it had to be the kind of thing where it got more interesting the more we went down the solution path. So the more the solution we built, the more interesting it became. Because there are a lot of businesses where you find a problem, you find a solution, but most of the interesting work happens in the first 20%, and then the rest of the life of the business is just scaling it out. And the problem there is that, A, it's hard to build a sustainable competitive advantage in that world because everybody else can come along and do the hard work in the first 20% and then scale it up as well. It also gets difficult to attract the best employees. It gets hard to attract the best investors because, again, all the interesting work was done in the early days, and now we're just here to try to like cookie cutter build the business on top of it. So finding something where the more you invested, the more you built the solution, the more interesting it got, is a great way to make sure those things don't happen, that employees get more engaged as time goes on. You get more engaged as time goes on. You don't get bored with the problem or bored with the business. And the third part was it had to be an area where I felt like there was an opportunity to do things radically different. So Outlier, we're at our core a business intelligence company, right? We're looking at data. And we're bringing you questions proactively about what's going on without you telling it what to look for. So you just connect Outlier to your data, and what you get in return are questions about what's going on, a handful of very high fidelity questions. We might be, and I don't know this, but we might be the first business intelligence product in history that doesn't have any dashboards. And almost every BI company, every BI product I've ever seen has at least one dashboard in it. Because dashboards, when people think about business intelligence, they think about dashboards. That's what they do. And the problem with that is, this goes back to what I talked about before, visible differentiation, is that once you start to do those things, you're not as different as you need to be. And there's not an opportunity. And there's a lot of products where you can't be as different as you might want to be. And so, for example, if we wanted to start a new CRM company today, the problem we run into is everybody uses Salesforce, and everybody expects that a CRM I replace Salesforce with should do the things that Salesforce does. And that means that we don't actually have a lot of opportunity to be innovative, to try something new. And we don't have a lot of opportunity to be visually differentiated, because most of what people want is for you not to be different. They want to be what they're familiar with. And so for me, a good solution was something that lend itself to doing things very differently and obviously separated from what's been done before. And so there's many different arrays of how we could have built Outlier. Outlier could have had dashboards in it. It wouldn't have been that hard to put dashboards in it. But having a solution where that wasn't necessary gave us a lot of ability to be more innovative and separate. That's paid off very much for us here 5 years into the company. So those are my only three criteria. And out of the array of different solutions we came up to, some of them met those criteria, some of them didn't. And then again, you go back to listening to customers and letting customers tell you what's working, what's not working, and what do they enjoy. And that becomes the North Star after you've kind of chosen that act.
Now, I want to sort of, go a little bit into your solution. I want to sort of, give you an example of a telecom company. And now you are sort of, dealing with the data of the telecom company. And what sort of questions should I anticipate when the data is processed?
So a lot of that depends on, obviously, what the data is. Outlier is what we call a semantic-free platform, meaning it doesn't rely on the semantics or the meaning of the data. Find questions for you. And so we work with the US government, we work with telecom companies, we work with large retailers, we work with large pharmaceutical companies, all of whom have different kinds of data, different kinds of things they're looking for. But at their core, if you think about it, all businesses are driven by customers. And so if you have a lot of data, it's very likely being generated by your customers. And the questions you care most about are, how is our customer behavior changing? How are our customers using our products differently? How are the demographics, who those customers are, how is that changing? And so when you connect Outlier to your data, let's say you're a telecom company, and let's say you connect Outlier to all of your mobile phone call records or those sorts of things, What it's doing is it's looking for patterns. It's looking for changes. It's looking for things where customer the things are behaving differently than they did before. It uses dozens of different forms of machine learning, of AI, in concert as part of a larger platform to extract patterns. And not just extract single patterns, but you know, if it finds a pattern, it goes down the rabbit hole for you. It says, okay, here's something interesting. Let me keep exploring this. Is there more to it? Is, you know, what are the potential causes of why this is happening? How can I best explain this to the customer? And so the end result of Outlier after connecting that data source is a series of questions, which we call stories, which look like they were written by an analyst. They look like analyst reports. They have charts, they have natural language explanations in them, they have additional information, additional context, suggested root causes. Essentially a question that you could pick up and feel like it was written for you by a person and decide what you want to do with it. Like, what do I want to answer this question? Or do I want to take action based on what this question is telling me is might be happening in the business? And that's the experience that we deliver. And it's the kind of thing that sounds like magic, right? How can software connect to my data and without me telling it what to look for, produce not 3 million questions, but like 3 to 5 key questions about what's going on? How does it do that? How does it know how to do that? And that's what I said about choosing a solution. It's the kind of thing where the more we invest, obviously the product and the platform is enormously complicated. It uses lots of machine learning because it can't rely on semantics. So it has to rely on statistical approaches. But the more we invest in it, the more it feels like magic. The more it is in some ways magic because customers get this experience that was not possible using any other kind of approach to the problem. And so that's a part that's exciting for me is you watch companies where for them, data was always a burden. They had so much data and there just weren't enough analysts or data scientists to be able to analyze it. So they never really got as much value out of it as they thought they should. And they're constantly reacting to changes that they find out about too late or they find out happened after the fact. And here we bring them a product that can analyze all that data and put them in the position of making decisions, put them in that empowering seat of not having to wonder what they're missing, but having those questions brought to them and they can decide if they're worth answering, they can decide they're worth pursuing. It's transformational for them and it's exciting. And I think a lot of that comes from starting with a problem that was so profound, but also making sure we stay dedicated to this idea that the best solution to this problem was not going to be the solutions that everybody else pursued over the years. It was going to be a very unique new approach to the problem, which is true. If you were to look at traditional BI products like Tableau and Outlier, and you were to pull back the curtain about how they work, Outlier looks nothing like what traditional BI tools look like. It doesn't have literally almost anything in common with how Tableau works. And that's necessary because, again, we started out with the problem. We didn't start out with the solution. So we were not constrained by the way previous solutions had been built. We weren't constrained by why people built Tableau in the way that they did. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with Tableau, but for the purposes of what we do in terms of automatically finding questions in data, we were not constrained by existing solutions, which allowed us and freed us up to find new solutions. And this new solution is just radically different, but does something that they can't do. And that's the innovation. That's that visible differentiation that people can see.
And do you have a, you know, I'm sure like, you know, you would say that, you know, we don't have any preference, perhaps, but still, you know, do you have a preferred industry, or do you think you have industry where your solution is better suited? You have more experience in dealing with a particular type of industry?
Oh, absolutely. Most of our customers are either CPG or e-commerce customers, and I'll tell you why. Which is those are businesses where they have enormously high data velocity, meaning that they have customers interacting with their products or buying their products in the millions every day. And those are also industries where they can't react in minutes. They can't react in hours. Often it takes them quite a while to react to changes in consumer preference, consumer behavior. If you're a CPG company, it can take you quarters to change your manufacturing supply chains to adjust to different preferences and products. If you're an e-commerce company, it can take you months to adjust your inventory supply chain to make sure you are selling what people want to be buying as their preferences change. And at the same time, they just have, in those industries, change is happening to you as much as you're making change happen. So there are industries where companies have quite a lot of control about what happens to them. And there's other industries where that's less true. And in CPG and e-commerce, that's definitely the case. So for them, outlier is essentially a way to turn all the data that they have from a burden into a competitive advantage. Because if they see shifts in consumer behavior before their competition, if they see shifts in consumer demographics before the competition, and the sooner they see those, the more likely it is they can take advantage of them and react and do something about them before anybody else knows that they're going on. And so, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence when you look at many products in the BI industry, they're used by certain people in an organization for certain purposes. Outlier is the kind of rare product that's used by everyone from executives to the managers, to the regional managers, to the operations teams. Because at the end of the day, everybody can benefit from having better questions. And especially in these CPG e-commerce businesses, like everyone who asks better questions can actually help meaningfully impact the business for the future. While we do sell to lots of other kinds of businesses, like I mentioned, most of our customers are in this CPG e-commerce space.
And if you look at the trend that we are at the moment, and you know, rightly so, we have more volume of transaction on because we are all staying home, especially on the e-commerce space. Do you think there is a rise of your customer in that perspective, or do you think, you know, that hasn't really changed much?
Oh, especially in 2020, it definitely has changed, because I think the pandemic has changed almost all businesses, but these sorts of businesses so profoundly that even if you before were resistant to change, even if before you thought you had a handle on how things work, here in 2020, at the end of 2020, you have no choice but to admit that you actually don't have a handle on things, that things have changed in ways you don't even know that they've changed. So, you know, at the core of it, when you think about a product like Outlier, what is Outlier doing? It looks at your data to bring you these unexpected insights, these questions about what's changing, things that you very likely did not know were happening. Essentially, what it's doing is helping you get a handle on the unknown, get a handle on the unexpected. And what do companies have no shortage of in 2020? Unknowns and unexpected things. So much is happening to them, and very little of what they knew about their business in previous years is even relevant anymore as things progress. And so Outlier has become an enormously powerful tool to help these companies stay on top of not just the amount of change, but the velocity and rapidity of the change in their industries. In some cases, that means that they used to have retail stores and e-commerce businesses, and all their businesses shifted e-commerce. In other cases, it means that the products that people are buying or the patterns of buying through their e-commerce sites is different. In a lot of cases, it means who's buying is entirely different, or at least how they're buying is different. It also means the competitive set of who else they'll consider buying from has changed. So as everything has changed, it gets very hard to stay on top of what's going on. At the same time, a lot of companies are struggling. They have a lot of issues. And what they're looking for is, where are those opportunities? Like, if everything is struggling, what's working, right? Where do I invest my time and effort? I may have, you know, millions of customer segments. You think about customers have ages and genders and locations, and you can have millions of customer segments because of how many different characteristics a customer has. Which out of those 3 million, which of them are buying more instead of less? Or which of them are buying more frequently? Or what products are they buying more frequently? And how do you figure that out in a fast enough way that you can act on it and invest in that kind of, let's call it a green shoot, that green shoot that you want to use as part of a recovery plan to keep growing into the future? Traditional methods don't work very well, but it turns out Outlier works very well for that, because it's designed to find these unexpected changes, and it can find those green shoots for you. And it does. And our website is full of case studies of exactly that happening. And so what we found is the whole category that we're in is called automated business analysis. And it is, in the course of 2020, going from being something that was new and innovative to being a necessity for these businesses, where we have been setting records for adoption and across even our existing customers, the amount of use of Outlier at our existing customers, meaning more teams and more people, more executives using Outlier to look at more of the data of the business, has been setting records all year. And I think that that's just because people realize they need a better handle on the unknown and the unexpected. And Outlier is one of the few tools that can help do that.
Mm-hmm. And going forward, like, you know, maybe, you know, there are challenges that you think like, this is something that we still need to figure out. There are some of the challenges that we have figured out and it's working well. Are there any particular challenges that you think you want to sort of, you know, solve, you know, going forward?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the biggest challenge for us going forward is the same of any new category going forward, which is how do we raise awareness that this type of solution even exists, right? How do we raise awareness of people that this is even an option? And not even outlier, this whole category of software, how do we make sure people are aware that this is even an option for them? Because what we find is that, you know, today, if you were to ask the average business, how can they better get ahead of the unexpected, the unknown? How can they better make sure that their data is becoming insight into these changes? They will tell you that the only solution they know of is to hire more people, to hire more data scientists, to hire more analysts. And especially right now in 2020, they probably don't have the budget to do that. But even if they did, there aren't enough people with enough expertise in that for every company to hire as many as they would need. And so for us, the challenge is, how do you raise awareness? How do you make sure people realize there are products like Outlier that can solve that same problem for you? Because once people realize that these products are available, they get excited. They want to try it. This has been such a profound problem for so long. People want a solution. But the biggest challenge is making sure they're aware that solutions even exist. Because, you know, for example, if you were to go to Google and look for a solution to this problem, what would you type in? What would you search for? Different people have different ways of describing it. They all have the same problem, but they might have a different language to describe it as well. And so the biggest problem for us, and this is true of any new category of software anywhere, which is, how do you raise awareness that the solution exists so people even know to give it a try? Because people who try it want to buy it, and people who buy it love it. And those parts are great. The part is, how do you make sure people even know that this is an option for them? And that will be, you know, that is always the primary challenge of business. And it will be for our whole industry for years until it becomes more mainstream. Today, people don't wonder, what is a dashboard, or do I need a dashboard? They don't sit around thinking like, I'll just have a person prepare my dashboard for me by hand. They're like, there's tools like Tableau that do that for you. But, you know, I don't know if we remember, you know, business intelligence is somewhat of a newer industry in the world, in that what we see as reporting today, if you go back 20 or 30 years, didn't really exist. And so markets like ours need to get mature before everybody understands that it fits into their day. And so we have to build awareness.
The kind of situation that we are at the moment, you know, that we are all working from home and we are using all the different intelligence tools to support us with our efficiencies and so forth. And in that perspective, you know, artificial intelligence has really somehow, it has become, this particular event has become a catalyst for the adoptions, right? Adoption rate of AI has been accelerated. Do you think AI is the answer for a lot of challenges that we have at the moment, either to do with the automations, either to do with solving healthcare-related issues as such? You know, what do you think, you know, your perspective? You know, I just want to know your perspective on that regard.
First, let me start off with a funny story. So I went to graduate school for machine learning, AI, 20 years ago. And back in our graduate program, we used to joke about the fact that we were working on things and algorithms that were great, but they weren't going to be relevant in our lifetimes. It would be generations before those algorithms would be used the way that they are today. And then, of course, 20 years later, that's changed, which just goes to show you just have to wait 20 years to look like a genius in retrospect. So,
but there you go.
I think that we are having a moment with AI, and I think that it's important to talk about why things are happening now. It's not that we've invented new technologies. Frankly, every machine learning algorithm, almost every machine learning algorithm used in any commercial application is in my textbooks from my graduate program 20 years ago. We haven't invented new ways of doing AI. We've gotten much better at using those same algorithms because with cloud computing and the commoditization, we can implement them at vastly larger scales and vastly more data. And that's a big difference. But that alone is not an explanation about why AI has caught on. And I think AI has caught on for a few reasons. One is that there's a few different classes of problems out there. There's a lot of problems that used to be solved by people where people simply can't do them anymore. And that would include stock trading. It includes ad buying online, things that have gone from being, you know, it used to be the case that stock trading was done on the floor of the stock exchange because people would trade stocks back and forth. And now most stock trades are done in milliseconds. No human can trade stocks in milliseconds. It used to be the case that ads were bought by people through agencies manually, and then people would slot them in. Now, almost all ads are bought through real-time auctions, and those real-time auctions complete in around 100 milliseconds. No human can do that. And so you've seen a whole class of problems that humans used to be able to do that have become so commoditized, so competitive that you can't do them with humans anymore. You need to have systems that can do them. And that's where machine learning has come in. That's one class of problem. The second class of problems are areas where the people have become very expensive in comparison to how much you can afford to pay for something to be done. And so that includes everything from, you know, document processing, to other things where you could have people do those that work, but the amount of money, the margins that are available in those businesses have shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And now the cost of people to do that job is just too high. And you have to have some other approach, which machine learning can do. And machine learning can be trained, and maybe it doesn't do the job the same way the human does, but it can do the same job differently and equally well for a small, small fraction of the price. And then the third category are going to be areas where the complexity has grown to the point that people need help. That people, Outlier is a good example where, you know, years ago when you had all your business data fit into a single Excel spreadsheet, you didn't need algorithms. You could sit there with your Excel spreadsheet, figure out what's going on. And today, as things have grown, data has gotten so big that you need help. And we don't want to replace the person, but that person needs help. They need to do things that they can't do. And there's not enough people in the world to hire them to do it. And that's given way to a whole new category of software around helping people do things by aiding them in doing that. And so if you think about those three different categories, the common theme behind them is that these were markets that changed, that there was some sort of impetus in that market that caused change. It wasn't that these companies decided that, oh, I want to change today. It's that the market changed underneath them. And there was an impetus where they had to change, and change left them open to new ideas about how to approach the problem. Because I think that any new technology like AI cannot take root unless there is a structural reason for people to change. And that's what's happened in these industries. And frankly, it's not a coincidence that Outlier is selling mostly into these e-commerce CPG companies. It's an industry going through enormous systemic change in the last few years and will be for the foreseeable future, where the status quo is no longer an option. You don't have the luxury of continuing to work the way that you've worked in the past. And there are industries where that's not true. There's industries that can, I think insurance is one example, where they aren't being forced to change. They may not choose to change in the near future, or they might, or change might come to them. But there's industries like that haven't had to change, where there's less adoption because there's less impetus for change. But I also think that one of the things that's also happened is that people have gotten a little bit carried away. And there's a lot of AI products out there right now, which are attempting to do things that humans can also do. And they aren't very compelling because either the problem isn't super complex, or the AI solution is not substantially cheaper, or it isn't something that has to be done by a computer. And so one example I'll give, there were stories recently about how there was a lot of excitement about inventory tracking robots in retail stores. How inventory tracking robots would save so much time and money because instead of having people go around the store taking inventory, these robots could just cruise around the store, scan all the shelves, tell you exactly what your inventory was at any given time. Now, it turns out a lot of those companies like Walmart that had adopted those are now rolling them back and going back to having people do store inventory. So what happened there? Well, it turns out that this is one of the great failures of artificial intelligence is that, you know, the problem with those robots, A, is it sounds in theory like it's cheaper because the robot just cruising around the store. But, you know, robots require maintenance, and maintenance can be quite expensive. So it actually is not as much cheaper than a person as it might seem on the surface. The other problem that you have is that, you know, if you rearrange the store, like you move something from shelf to shelf, you can just tell the person who's doing inventory that changes and they can adjust immediately. A 2-second conversation, you're good to go. For a computer to do the same thing, you'd have to reset their layout of the store. You have to reconfigure their entire understanding of where the store should be and how it should be laid out. And that means, again, the overhead of maintaining it is a lot higher than it might otherwise seem. And so a lot of these AI products have hidden costs to them that make them cost ineffective and are being applied to problems that aren't super ideal. And I think that is also something that's happening as well. So the good news is that the solutions that are solving those three categories of problems that I mentioned that really are designed for it are thriving. And I think it's exciting to see how fast they're being adopted and how radically they're changing how business is done. But there's also categories of where it's being applied that aren't working. And I think they are being backed out. And I think it's because of those reasons that I listed.
Interesting, because clearly, like, you know, you see a lot of companies have started the AI initiative, and obviously like you mentioned, some of them perhaps are not solving anything, or maybe it's solving something, but then not to an extent where it adds any kind of efficiency, or rather it becomes a liability for the company itself, right? So
Exactly. And yeah, like I said before, there are going to be a lot of there's a lot of innovation that, and there's a lot of venture capital money that might flow into ideas or problems where there is no solution. There might not be a better way to do it than the way people do it today. I think that, for example, if you think about agriculture, we think a lot about industrial robotics and agriculture, and that's exciting. But even today in 2020, the vast majority of our food is handpicked by people. It's if you take the average person and you show them how your average industrial farm is working, usually they're very shocked at it. But the reality is we haven't found a better way. And there may not be a better way, or at least the better way may not be possible for years. And it's just really interesting to think about that, as exciting as these technologies are, there's things they can do very well. Like Outlier can connect to data, can find these unexpected questions. It can analyze it and make you more proactive. But you know, years ago, there were a bunch of technology solutions of what was called prescriptive analytics, meaning that they would tell you what to do. They would not only look at your data and see things, they would tell you what you should do about it. And those have largely failed for similar reasons that those inventory control robots haven't been working out, which is, you know, frankly, to be able to tell you what to do in your business, the software has to have a full understanding of how your business works and all the different options that you might be able to choose. And that's something that changes all the time. And that's something that software, at least today, has not gotten to the point where it can do effectively.
Okay. So I would like to sort of, you know, ask you a little bit about your background together with asking you your motivation towards being an entrepreneur or being able to solve a particular problem. What motivates you to sort of, you know, maybe awake a few nights, you know, in a week?
I can start with you why I became a founder in the first place, which is a somewhat non-traditional reason, which is I've always been the kind of person that liked lots of different things. I admit, different points in my career, I was illustrator, I was a DJ on the radio. I mean, I liked engineering, I liked math. There's lots of things that I liked, and I wasn't satisfied with jobs where I didn't have a chance to do such a wide variety of things. I found that I got bored. And so for me, starting companies was a chance to be able to do lots of different things and feel more fulfilled in that. But also it was that, you know, early in my career, I worked with a lot of companies, and frankly, most places, this goes back to our discussion about diversity and inclusiveness, they don't treat their employees like people. They treat their employees like widgets where you feed in a salary one end and productivity comes out the other end or something. And I didn't feel like I was seen as a person. I wasn't seen as somebody who wanted to learn, who wanted to grow, who wanted to be challenged. I was seen as somebody who was expected to show up and do a bunch of things to move the business forward. And I wanted to work at somewhere like that. I wanted to work in a company that saw me like a person where I felt like I could learn and I could expand my horizons. And I was seen as the whole person that I was and not just the specific kind of productivity they wanted me to create. And there just weren't a lot of places like that. I realized I had to start my own if I wanted to work somewhere like that. And that is actually what got me into starting companies in the first place, was the motivation of wanting to create a work environment that I wanted to work at. And so the combination of those two are what keeps me going. And it also tells you a bit about why I found it might be easier than most people to focus on the problem and not the solution, in that I wasn't in this to build an app or build something specific or build it in a certain way. I didn't love a specific technology. All I really wanted to do was create a great place to work and something that challenged me in many different ways. And that, I think, for me, has worked really well overall. And it's, I will say that I look back at my career and I've loved every minute of it. It hasn't always been easy. Most of the time, it's been really hard and stressful and difficult, but it's always made me feel like it was worth it. I never look back and say I would have rather spent that time on something else.
And being an entrepreneur, what is more challenging? You know, when you look at the variety of things that as a leader does, what is more challenging? Is it to hire people, or to find investors, or to even manage the process, or to find a solution? So, as such, what is more challenging?
Oh, the hardest part of starting a business is hiring people, by far, 1,000%. Because you know, it's not that raising money is hard. And I will confess, it's my least favorite part of at least venture-backed startup companies. Actually, of all companies, because almost everybody has to raise capital of one form or another. that's my least favorite part. But the hardest part by far is hiring, because especially in the early days, if it's just you or just you and a co-founder, to convince those early people to take a risk on you is very hard. And then as you're growing, it's also difficult to do all the things I've described in terms of focusing on diversity, focusing on building a great team, trusting people, at the same time of having so little time and so little money and so few resources, and being under such pressure and stress to try to perform and try to make things work. It's very hard. It's like trying to put together a puzzle while you're on a roller coaster. There's so much going on. It's very hard to do. And it's why I think a lot of founders don't do it. Don't put the hard work into thinking about their team and how they build it, because so much else is going on. It's so hard to do it. And that's why I think it ends up being a competitive advantage if you do it, because so few people have a chance to do it as part of their company building process. And so if you do it well, though, the later years of the company become much easier. If you do it poorly, the later years of the company become much, much more difficult. And so hiring is easily the most difficult part of the problem by far.
All right, Son. It was a wonderful conversation with you. We went through a series of different topics, and I really, really like what you are into at the moment. And hopefully we would like to sort of, you know, have this conversation one day physically as well, you know, in future.
That would be great.
When you have more awareness about, you know, outlier in more wider spectrum. So then, you know, it would be very interesting conversation about what you guys are up to at the time.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a great conversation. I really appreciate it. And yes, I look forward to doing it again sometime soon when maybe the world is changing it again.
Yeah.
And maybe for the better this time.
Okay.